kind of like the old days where we had overhead projectors, because then you could write on them and make notations. Maybe a good project for someone would be to write some software so that we could write on a pad and annotate on the multiple screens. I'm afraid that only the people up here in the front are going to be able to see the pointer, so I hope it makes some sense. In some ways it looks prettier with the electronic presentation, but maybe not as functional. My name is Rick Walker, and I've been working in the field of clock and data recovery since about 1984, 85, something like that. Oh, you found the bag. Okay, great. Thanks. I've been working at Hewlett-Packard Labs and now Agilent Laboratories since 1982. Started working there as a summer student my junior year, and then came back after I graduated from Caltech, and have been in the same department actually ever since. So this is my 20th year. Somewhere around 1984-85, a fellow named Bill Worley was doing computer architectures at HP, and said that the world would soon be moving in the direction to where we would have centralized servers, memory servers actually, with a bunch of processors clustered around them and communicating to the memory with gigabit per second links. So the task was given to our department to come up with ways to make these gigabit per second links. And this is where we first started looking at bang-bang phase detectors by Alexander as a way to do this monolithically. Prior to getting forced into that kind of a realization, I remember some of the things that we had been working on, which involved big pieces of sapphire with delay lines on it, and the idea was you send a bunch of bits on these delay lines and they curve around, and you have a bunch of FETs which then fire and sample and hold the data at a much lower rate from some kind of a microwave pulse generator. It was just a nightmare to think of these things being in PCs that people might actually be able to use and manufacture. So what I'd like to do in this talk is actually, the assumption for the short course was that this is not really a tutorial. The assumption is that people are pretty familiar with the fields, but I thought I should at least give some kind of an overview of serial data communications, and I have that organized by talking briefly about degradation mechanisms and data coding, and then talking about various jitter measurements, because the function of a clock and data recovery circuit is to follow the timing of the zero crossings in the data. And they vary due to aberrations in the channel, and it's necessary to characterize that to understand how the phase-like loop is going to respond to it. And so the main ways that people characterize these is the various jitter measurements, so we'll talk about those. Finally, we'll move into clock recovery methods, and I'm just going to briefly gloss over linear phase-like loop theory. There's a lot of this in the literature. You can get the book by Floyd Gardner, and you can look at papers, and it's very well analyzed. And even though it's the last indented bullet, this is going to be the bulk of the talk, bang-bang loop theory, how you can use bang-bang loops, analyze them, and design with them. In the past, historically, people have communicated from chip to chip with buses. Mini pins, and then a data or a clock bit, which then tells the receiver when to latch all the bits. As people have tried to go to higher and higher density systems, if you want to go about a meter on a PC board, it turns out that, try as you might, you really can't go any faster than about 500 megahertz clock, just because of the skew and the dielectric variations and the output driver timing variations. You'll end up with the bits, after they arrive, being out of sync with the clock. And that limits the system performance. So what we're seeing is that in modern systems, these two captions are reversed here, in things like from CPU through a crossbar over to memory. This is kind of like Bill Worley's application, except it's all one multiprocessor and it's in a box rather than an office. What people are doing is they're serially encoding the data, and they're no longer using parallel buses. Similar here in a line card to router, you have multiple line cards, and the data comes in, needs to go over to a router card, get switched, and then come back and then sent back out. By going to serial coding and embedding the clock in the data, we can then, over, say, 1 meter of PC board, transmit at 4 or 5 gigabits per second. So it's about an eightfold jump in system performance. And I believe that at least for the next couple of years, we're going to be limited to somewhere around 4 or 5, maybe with some kind of equalization, 10 gigabits per second over a PC board. But we're starting to see that this whole field is becoming a bit more mature, in that if you take into account the best cost-performance trade-off, it doesn't really make sense to use a lot of exotic equalization like you might for a telephone modem, because bandwidth is free. You just put more copper traces on the board. And so when you start to run into skin loss and dielectric loss, it's best just to sort of run at the maximum speed you can and not to push too much harder. So we're seeing systems that have thousands and thousands of traces all at 4 and 5 gigabits per second. So an interest in serial or monolithic clock and data recovery. I wanted to show the evolution of this field over time, and this graph shows papers as published in the Solid State Circuits Conference from 1988 until the present conference. And I've graphed serial link speed on the left axis, going from 20 megabits per second to 50 gigabits per second, and on the same number of orders of magnitude, I'm graphing on the right axis the internet host count, a measure of how big the internet has gotten. There are three bands shown here, a pink, a green, and a blue band. These are the FT trend lines for CMOS, silicon germanium, and silicon bipolar. And I've shown these as bands because in looking at the literature, I've made the observation that a naive clock and data recovery implementation will come in at about 1/20th of FT. A state-of-the-art implementation will come in at around 4/10th of FT. And we'll talk about some of the tricks that you can use to get to the higher end of that band. Another thing I wanted to point out is that we tend to think of these links as sort of just an inexorable evolutionary trend that started a million years ago or something. But actually, back in 1990, we had processes which were capable of building 10 gigabit links. There just wasn't any commercial need for doing that. So although we could have, we didn't. And in fact, some years later, in the same process that we had back then, this group here did a 10 gigabit per second link, 1998, which actually at that time was canceled because there really wasn't a market for it, and now we're desperately trying to redo the same thing in 2001. But what I wanted to point out is that this evolution is basically driven by the growth of the internet. Prior to the internet becoming significant, people were dabbling around here at 155 megabits, but then as the need for global communication bandwidth rose, basically there was the development to keep up with it. And you can see always slightly ahead is bipolar development. The CMOS lagged for quite a long time because it had to wait for the CMOS trend line to get up here such that sophisticated designs would be capable of doing 10 gigabits per second. That wasn't possible in 96 or even 1990. Now, although processes like silicon germanium will allow us to go 20 to 50 gigabits, and maybe even higher, I believe that those will really only see wide application in long-haul fiber optic systems, but not in PC board backplanes due to these connector skin loss and dielectric loss limits. For instance, skin loss is dependent on the conductivity of copper, which is sort of the best conductor that we have. You can go to silver, it's 5% better, but then it oxidizes and it's worse. So until we get things like room temperature superconductors or optical backplanes, we can go into analysis. I believe, however, that we're going to end up seeing systems which are more parallel and which saturate at around 5 gigabits per second on the backplane. One of the tricks that people use to get up to the high end of this performance curve is using multi-phase sampling. If you have a single latch, it has a pretty small aperture time such that if you trigger it, it will sample the voltage within a few picoseconds of time. and turn that into a digital level. However, it has to regenerate for a fair amount of time to make that decision, and you can't trigger it again very fast. So to go at the highest speed, you end up building systems that sample in a round-robin fashion using multiple latches, and then you can go to a much higher rate. And so in parentheses, I've shown the number of phases, and you can see that, for instance, this bipolar design to reach sort of the limits of the bipolar FT curve had to use 4 phases, and this design used 2 phases. And these down near the bottom are single-phase designs. Another interesting way of looking at the progress over time is to graph complete transceivers from ISSCC also on this graph. Often people get into the mindset that faster is always better. But if you're trying to build a system which is maximizing performance in a box with a given size and a given amount of power, you really have to think about what the die size is and what the power is. And if you could do 20 gigabits, but it costs you 4 times the power of 10 gigabits, then you're being crazy. Unless it's driving a $1 million installed fiber plant, and then power doesn't matter. But inside a computer or router, you really have to look at these two metrics. Link speed per unit power, gigabits per watt. How much power did it cost you for every gigabit? And then this one, link speed per unit die size. Because if you're talking about a high-end microprocessor, it doesn't make any sense to use up 90% of the space for your I/O drivers, because then you have no place for the microprocessor. So you really have to care about die size also. I've drawn two sort of goals on here. This line, if you've reached this line in the Y direction, you are capable of doing 1 terabit per second of bidirectional I/O in 40 watts. A typical high-end microprocessor that's aggressively cooled can dissipate about 100 watts. And so if you were to use 40% of that for I/Os, which is reasonable because they're the most power-hungry thing because they have to drive 50 ohm lines, that would be the amount of power that you'd have to reach to get a terabit on a single chip. A typical high-end microprocessor will be something like 3 by 3 centimeters on a side. That's 9 square centimeters. If you allocated a ring for I/O drivers that use 20% of that space, leaving 80% of the space for the core router or the core processor, then you would hit this line, 1 terabit per second and 1.8 square centimeters. And we're seeing that over time, and actually I have some data points that aren't on here, we're actually seeing designs that have been reported that actually fall up in this range. So a terabit on a single piece of silicon is quite reasonable. One thing I want to point out is most of these designs are all NRZ data. Some people have been going to multi-level coding. When you go to multi-level coding, it's always three picojoule. What's the metric? It's 3 picojoules per sample per second, I think, is the state of the art in A to D converters. And when you compute the power that's necessary for the A to D converter in the multi-level system, it automatically drops you about a factor of 2 back from the state of the art in terms of power and die size. Okay, so let's talk about serial data transmission. Some of these reasons that I just alluded to for the multi-phase systems, we find that most of the high-performance systems are still using non-return to zero or binary data signaling, where you have one level to represent a one, one level to represent a zero. There is no clock. If you have multiple ones in a row, you just send them as a sustained level. The transmission channel distorts the signal in various ways. Here I show some kind of a bandwidth roll-off with ringing. And this may end up moving the edges around, causing jitter. So from this signal, we have to recover both clock and data. It's kind of like sitting in on a jazz band, and you know the drummer goes ta-da-ta, and you've got to get the beat and then come in with the melody in sync with them. So basically, we do something like a PLL function when we try to get the beat out of some music. And CDRs are basically just a way to do that in circuitry. Some of the signal degradation mechanisms that can occur are AC coupling droop, which causes a sustained bunch of ones to sag a little bit because the capacitor charges. Because this has gotten to a lower voltage and this is slew rate limited, this signal will cross the threshold sooner than it would have. It'll pull the edge in. There are optical pulse dispersions for lasers and for cables. I already mentioned skin and dielectric loss. There's random noise in the system on the power supply and various sorts of noises due to digital logic in the system. various kinds of crosstalk from the drivers at both the near and far end, inter-symbol interference due to finite bandwidth in the channel. You can generally model most of these channels. If you were to run a simulation and look at each zero crossing and then say whether it came early or late and then put it in a table that was indexed by what the previous in-bit patterns were, you would find that you get a deterministic pattern that is stable, so that the location of each edge is determined by the past k bits, and the more bandwidth reduction you have, the longer k is. That's called inter-symbol interference. And we're finding that when people are trying to push up into the 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 gigabits per second, that the connector discontinuities are also becoming very significant and requiring very power-hungry adaptive equalizers to null out the glitches that occur. So one of the ways to get around some of these degradations is coding the data. A simple code that people have used for a long time is, Manchester is one, where to avoid the problem of having a lot of bits in the row being identical and not being able to extract a clock, you can always send a 1 as a 0-1 pulse and send a 0 as a 1-0 pulse. You always have a transition, and it goes through a coupling capacitor real easy. The problem is that it takes twice as many bits to send the same amount of information. So in the evolution of codes, people have moved to things like an 8B, 10B code, where for every byte of data, some of which might be all zeros or all ones, you substitute for that 10 bits of data, and you choose among the higher number of bits available in a 10-bit block, such that you only choose the ones which are pretty well DC balanced and have good transition density. That allows you to achieve DC balance, high transitions. You can make sure that the run length is bounded so that the phase lock loop is easy to do. But what we're concerned about is coding efficiency. Manchester coding was 100% efficiency overhead. AP10B was 25% efficiency. Some of the things you can do with codes is you can shape the spectrum. I already mentioned with 8B10B that you can achieve DC balance, so it's easier for it to go through a coupling capacitor. You can also shape the high frequency energy, so you can make a narrow band code, actually. And many variations are possible. I won't go into any more details, but if you go look in the literature, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of techniques that people have come up with for coding data. Now, when someone builds a link, one of the first things they're interested in is what is the bit error rate. And this is typically measured with a bit error rate test. And a bit error rate test looks like this. We have our link, our system under test, TX and RX. And we make a special data generator that can send a pseudo-random bit sequence. This is a shift register with some feedback. Typically, it's an in-bit register. And these are mathematically designed such that the pattern is 2 to the n minus 1 bits long. And every single in-bit pattern that is possible occurs once within that cycle, and then it repeats, except for the n zeros in a row case. So it exhaustively tests all the patterns. We use that pattern to transmit across the link, and we receive it by a synchronized data receiver. We then take the number of bits that we error bits that we've detected on the link and divide by the total number of bits, and that's the bit error rate. A typical link for serial communications is designed to be better than 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 12. That's not very good at 10 gigabits per second because you're going to be making an error on the average every 1,000 seconds. And this can be really critical because if you make an error on a packet and you load it into your hard disk and it's part of your operating system, you've got a time bomb there. Someone's life support system could fail, or not to get so macabre, every time you execute a certain point of code, the system will crash. And the only way to fix that, I mean, it'd be very difficult to find the problem. The only way to fix it really is to do a complete reinstall. And although I know that people are getting fairly used to reinstalling the common operating systems on a regular basis, this is not a good thing for a designer to have designed. So typically what people will do is they'll use error correction. With a good error correcting code, you can take a 10 to the minus 4 link and drive it to 10 to the minus 12, or in a 10 to the minus 12 link, you can drive it down to 10 to the minus 20. Or error detection, putting cyclic redundancy check and using packets, and then if the packet has an error, then you retry it. And the goal then would be to make it so that you never see any errors really at all. As for instance, for 10 gigabit Ethernet, the goal for the transmission system on a packet-by-packet basis was that when a packet came in and you received it, the odds of falsely accepting that packet and loading it into the memory have to be so low that it occurs on any given link no more often than once in every 60 billion years. That was actually the design spec for the system. And so you want to take this fairly seriously, because it really is a disaster if you have uncorrected errors. The next level of detail getting into how a link works is to look at these link aberrations in more detail. And the first thing that most people do is look at an eye diagram. An eye diagram is done by using basically the same pseudo-random data generator with a code which is representative of the kind of code that you're going to use. You drive the system and you receive it on a scope with an accurate trigger. This is like taking the aberrated signal, breaking it into chunks which are exactly one data period in width, and then overlaying them all so that you get a plot that looks like this. From mean zero crossing to mean zero crossing, this is called a unit interval, one unit interval. And you will typically have a mask in here saying that with a given probability, the transitions all fall outside of this mask. Another way this is often characterized is by using a scope that can do histogramming, so that you can put a threshold here at X and then look at the time arrival histogram of the zero crossings, or put a slicing point at Y and look at the voltage distribution at the sample point of the eye. So we're going to drive a latch here with the recovered clock and then decide whether we have a 1 or a 0. Now, what is jitter? This is one way of looking at it. Ideally, our zero crossings on the data would all occur at exact multiples of a unit interval. However, due to inter-symbol interference and other problems on the link, sometimes the zero crossings will occur a little bit late, and sometimes they'll occur a little bit early. If we plot the arrival time as a function on an axis and then make the abstraction that we can connect the dots and treat this as a continuous time signal, then we have a waveform, which is the jitter waveform, and we'll be able to take FFTs of this and look at its spectrum, look at its amplitude, and other things. So let's look at some of the typical jitter measurements. There's basically two ways in which jitter are characterized, and I have them basically from simple to complex, although the sonnet style, the more complex jitter measurement technique, is the oldest one. It goes back at least a decade and a half, maybe two decades. It's based on frequency domain methods. Lately, Ethernet and Fibre Channel have adopted simpler methods which are based on time domain eye diagrams, where they look at the deterministic jitter in the link that's due to pattern dependencies and bandwidth limitations, and they look at the random jitter, which is basically due to clock noise. In Sonnet, there are three frequency domain specifications: tolerance, transfer, and generation. So let's go through these in turn. To measure deterministic and random jitter, we basically use an eye diagram measurement, and we're going to look at the distributions of the zero crossings of the data. This is a simpler way of specifying the data, but it's not nearly as powerful in an analytic sense as the Sonnet technique. The jitter is decomposed into two components, a random jitter component and a deterministic jitter component. To measure the random jitter component, you put in a repetitive clock-like pattern, typically 101010. Or if you have an 8B10B code, you take the 10-bit code, which most closely approximates a 1010 pattern. And then you measure the RMS jitter at the zero crossings of the eye diagram. This is mostly due to noise in the VCO and in the clock generation of the transmitter. It's mostly Gaussian. Then you put in a very complicated scrambled pattern, a random data coded by your code, and you measure the peak-to-peak jitter. And this jitter distribution is likely to be relatively rectangular because it's driven by specific patterns rather than a Gaussian phenomenon. So once you've measured this histogram, you deconvolve out the previously measured RJ contribution, and then you have a DJ and an RJ term, which you can then write into your specs and put limits on. The difficulty with this kind of a specification is that in a system with a phase-lock loop, the jitter actually is tracked out. And the ability to track the jitter depends on what frequency the jitter is moving around at. Low frequency jitter is very aggressively tracked, and you follow right along. As the jitter goes higher, the loop is less able to track, and then it starts to close the eye. These two specifications don't say anything about the frequency components of the data, and so are not nearly as sophisticated. So let's look at some of the SONNET specifications. There's three: tolerance, transfer, and generation. The first one is jitter tolerance, and we take a system under test. In this case, I'm showing a laser transmitter. So we have a transmitter, a optical attenuator, and a fiber, and a receiver. We're going to drive it with a bit error rate source, so this is a coded random pattern, and we're going to take the clock of that data generator, and we're going to sinusoidally modulate it so that the actual eye diagram is moving back and forth at some sinusoidal rate. The amount it's moving back and forth is specified in unit intervals with respect to a bit time, and the frequency is the jitter frequency, the frequency at which it moves back and forth. At each frequency, we're going to increase the amplitude of this jitter modulation generator until the bit error rate has degraded the same amount that it would have degraded if we had increased the optical attenuation by 1 dB. Now, in electrical systems, you don't have optical attenuators, so what the common practice is you increase the modulation until the bit error rate goes from 0 to 10 to the minus 12. Or 10 to the minus 9. Basically, when you do the specification, you write down what threshold of bit error rate you used to specify the tolerance. Once you've done the measurement, you can plot it on the specification. So you have the number of unit intervals of modulation here on the left. You have the frequency at which you're driving the system, and you do it point-wise. For each frequency, you do a separate measurement. You increase the amplitude until it fails. And your system had better fall in a line that's above this mask. And these are some of the typical frequencies and amplitudes for the various SONNET data rates. Typically, this point is the most difficult point for most phase-lock loops, because phase-lock loops track first order and then will usually go second order, and these are first order and then plateaus. So if you can tolerate it here, usually the loop will be improving even at lower frequencies. The jitter transfer function measurement is a measurement of, in a repeater, if I put a jitter signal on the input of the repeater, how much does the repeater attenuate it, or how well does it track the jitter as it's going through or making its decision? And the transfer function measurement is very similar to the transfer function measurement that you would make with a network analyzer. So this is basically a standard, you know, Anritsu HP Tektronix network analyzer that puts out a carrier, and then you put it into a device under test, and it measures the input voltage divided by output voltage, gives you a transfer function. The problem is that we're interested in a jitter transfer function, not a frequency transfer function. So we want to know the output jitter, 20 log of the output jitter divided by the input jitter. So basically what I'm doing in this block diagram is we take the frequency output of the network analyzer, and we use it to phase modulate a clock with a phase modulator. That clock is then used to jitter the clock of our bit error rate transmitter. It goes into the device under test, and we take the clock from our device under test and run it into phase detector. That converts the jitter, the time arrival jitter of the clock edges, into a voltage, which can then be put back into the network analyzer, so we can measure the transfer function. And actually, there's a good book here you can look up in the references, Trishita and Varma, Jitter and Digital Systems, which talks about all this in really good detail. The jitter transfer spec then looks like this. We have the frequency at which we've jittered the signal, and we have the jitter gain of the system here on the left axis. And phase-lock loops will generally track very close to unit amplitude at low frequencies because they have a high loop gain. And most phase-lock loops are second order, so there'll be a little bit of peaking right here at the cutoff. So this is saying that within a certain loop bandwidth, you have to track the jitter, and if any jitter occurs at a frequency higher than the cutoff, you need to attenuate it at least single pole. The reason this spec is 0 dB with a little bit extra above it, in this case 0.1 decibels, is because they're trying to control jitter peaking in a long cascade of repeaters. If you had 0.1 dB in one repeater and you went through 10 repeaters, that'd be 1 dB. And if you went through another, you know, 10 times as many, you'd have 10 dB. Pretty soon, the system would be unstable. finally, jitter generation. This is a measurement of how clean your transmitter is. And because Sonnet is a standard for driving very, very long fiber optic systems, in which case, maybe with installation and fiber cost, you've got a little box of electronics driving $10 million worth of fiber, you really want to make sure that the electronics works really well. So they have a jitter generation spec that says at the transmitter, you're allowed at most 1% of a unit interval of RMS noise. Very, very clean transmitted signal. The way that's measured is you take your transmitter and you take the clock signal and look at it on a spectrum analyzer. Actually, there's many ways to do this. This is just one way. You look at it on the spectrum analyzer. That gives you the phase noise spectrum around the clock, so the phase noise sidebands. You can then digitize that spectrum on a computer, and basically we've measured the sidebands around the clock frequency. In Sonnet, they specify a 12 kilohertz high-pass filter on the jitter sidebands, so we have to multiply the jitter components by a filter mask. I usually do this on the digitized phase noise information with a script on a computer. The reason you do that is because most oscillators are going to have 1 over F, 1 over F squared, 1 over F cubed, and if you were to integrate all the way down to zero, then the energy in those low-frequency components becomes unbounded, and you can't talk about what the RMS noise is. It has all kinds of random walk terms in it. When you use a high-pass filter, it cuts out those low-frequency components, and now we can talk about RMS noise. It's a stable statistic. So we measure it, we multiply by the mask, then we RMS sum up all the noise voltages over the band. I usually use trapezoidal integration, and you end up, when you're done, with a total noise power in all of the sidebands. You can then make this diagram where you have the clock amplitude, power in the clock, and you have the computed RMS power in the sidebands. The half angle here is going to be the arctangent of this over that, and that will be the RMS noise. And the peak-to-peak RMS noise, it can swing in both directions as this sideband randomly moves around in a circle, is going to be 2 times the arctangent of this over that. And for Sonnet, 0.01 unit intervals is what you're allowed. Okay, moving on to clock recovery. Most of the data that's transmitted is coded using NRZ. I already mentioned that term once. Now I'll define it. This is NRZ, non-return to zero, as contrasted with RZ, return to zero. In return to zero coding, you send your pulse for half the bit time, then you return to zero. So this is a 1. So you go blip for half the time, then a 0, and another 1, and another 1. The interesting thing about RZ is that it has a clock component in it. NRZ does not have a clock component. An interesting trick for seeing whether something has a Fourier component is to look back at the definition of a Fourier transform and realize that you take your basis vector, in this case a sine wave at the clock frequency, and you multiply it by f of t dt. F of t is the signal you want to know the Fourier component of, which in this case is our data pattern. So we take the basis vector and we point by point multiply it by the signal we're interested in looking for the spectrum, and we integrate all those terms. So you can see that for the clock signal, it always has 1 positive cycle and 1 negative cycle exactly within each bit. When you multiply those point by point, this contribution cancels that clock. That contribution, there's no clock term in NRZ, complete null. In NRZ, because we only put out for half the cycle, there is a clock term. However, NRZ signaling is almost universally used because it puts out the maximum voltage, if you have a peak voltage limit and a CMOS driver, for the maximum amount of time. There's the maximum transmitted energy. So you really want to put the most energy out to have the most effective link. And then you have to figure out at the receive end how to get the clock component back out of it. So here's what the spectrum actually looks like of NRZ. Here's the missing clock frequency right at the middle. This is 1 over T, or the clock frequency. And depending on how you coded the data, you'll have various DC roll-offs at the end, if it's a DC balanced code. Whenever you take 2 sine waves and run them through a nonlinearity, say a square law device, what you get is the sum and difference of all the harmonics of all the signals, and they come out in the output with various gain terms depending on how strong the nonlinearity was. So it turns out that in this spectrum, there's a kind of a symmetry here around the clock, so that this tone right here, this red line on the left, is exactly coherent with this tone here on the right. And this one is at the clock minus delta, and this one is at the clock plus delta. So if I were to take this whole thing and jam it through some kind of a nonlinearity, any kind of a nonlinearity, all of these frequency components are going to mix, all of these frequency components are going to mix with each other and produce sum and difference terms of all possible combinations. The ones which are coherent, the pairs on either side of the clock, will sort of meet each other at the dance and neutralize out and produce a clock tone. All the other ones which are incoherent will make a noise floor. So when you put this through nonlinearity, you get a white noise floor and you get a clock tone standing out proud in the middle of it, which you can then filter. So to optimize this a little bit, what people often will do is they'll take the signal and differentiate it first. And what the differentiating does, this is falling off sine x over x or a single pole slope. If you differentiate it, it makes both these humps the equal size, so that when the two pairwise frequencies meet each other, you get the maximum cross product. So prior to about, well, say 1984, and maybe even up until 1987 or so, this was the general technique for doing clock and data recovery, these differentiate and rectify method. It's not monolithic, but it works really well. So here's the general scheme. You take a derivative, then you run it through a square law device, you follow it with a bandpass filter, a resonator, dielectric resonator, soft filter, something like that. Here's another way that people did it. You make a power splitter and you run it through a delay line, and then you mix it with itself using a diode mixer. So this could be a little mini circuits, 10 gig mixer, and then you run it into a bandpass filter. This delay and mix with itself is kind of like a differentiation, and this is the nonlinear. Here's one that saw a lot of use at low frequencies, maybe 10 megabits per second. You take a differential ECL gate and you run it through two high-pass differentiators, and then you make a bridge rectifier, narrow glitches, and this reverses them to turn it into something like RZ, and then you run it into a tank. So in summary, you can really easily extract a clock by running it through some kind of this nonlinear chain and filtering, and you can then use that clock to retime the data, and you've cleaned it up, you made a nice digital signal again, and you've gotten rid of a lot of the jitter. It's very simple to implement. You can make it with microwave tinker toys from mini circuits or whatnot, up to 20, 30 gigabits, no big deal, just wire it together. The problem is, you've extracted the frequency, but you have no idea what the phase should be. And in fact, in something like a soft filter is a transversal filter, and it can have up to 400 or 500 cycles of the clock pipelined in it. So if the temperature changes slightly, the phase goes all over the map coming out of that soft filter. So it's very hard to keep this centered in the middle of the eye diagram. So in the traditional, I think on the previous slide I had some references, and if you look it up, one of those is a long-haul saw repeater system that was used for undersea transmission. And what they did in that paper is they built the electronics, then they put it in a temperature chamber and characterized what the temperature coefficient of the electronics was. Then they previously had cut hundreds of soft filters at different angles, that they all had different temperature coefficients, and put them into bins. They would then take the soft filter with the temperature coefficient that matched the electronics, which had a lot of discretes in it, so it varied all over the map. They would match those two together, and then they would have a technician hand-cut a piece of hardline coax to get it centered in the eye, and then they would just hope that the temperature of the ocean doesn't change very much. So the last drawback that I wanted to point out with these sorts of systems is that this differentiating produces very narrow pulses, and that's very hard to do if you don't have a high FT. Unless you have a high FT, you can't make very narrow pulses. In fact, it may be that the best you can do is just make a latch that works at the frequency of the clock, and you can't make any narrower pulse, in which case this would be very hard to do at a high frequency. It's also very hard to integrate a high Q filter. Just to define Q, the voltage envelope of a ringing circuit falls to 1 over square root E in Q radians. So in Q over 2 pi cycles, we fall to 1 over square root E. So in a long run length of the data where you're sending a whole bunch of ones in a row, the filter has to keep ringing and provide the clock, and the amplitude is constantly falling. So if you have a code with a long run length, you need a high Q, maybe several hundred. Typically on a chip, if you make a LC resonator, you can only get a Q of 5 or 10 or something like that due to the poor characteristics of on-chip inductors. Q is also numerically equal to the center frequency of the resonator divided by the full width half power of the resonance. So it's this half power of the filter bandwidth divided into the center frequency. So the realization here is that we can emulate a high-Q filter if we use a phase-lock loop. It operates at a high carrier frequency, but its transfer function is a function of the loop bandwidth. So it's like a high-Q filter, although it is integrable and requires no inductors or capacitors. So then we can move on to something which for the first time is nicely integrable. This would be data recovery using a simple phase lock loop where the jittered data signal comes in and we have a way to compare the zero crossings in the data to the zero crossings of the voltage controlled oscillator. That basically mixes those zero crossings down to baseband where we can filter them in a loop filter, and the voltage out of this loop filter is basically an error signal which tells the VCO to speed up to do a better job of tracking, or to slow down. And so this is quite easily integrable. All these things can be built on chip, but we still have the same problem. Unless we're very careful, this phase detector will not have the same prop delay characteristics or temperature characteristics or process variation characteristics as this latch, and we'll have done a great job of extracting the frequency, but we won't know what the proper sampling phase is. So in my graph that shows evolution of clock and data recovery over time, and actually there's another graph coming up which will make this point even more clear, the papers which are using analog phase detectors which produce very, very narrow pulses, they're able to be integrated, but they run at something like 1/20th of FT. They don't run at the highest possible speeds because of this matching problem. So we're moving on to how you would build an analog loop. I won't go into too much detail because this is covered very well in the literature. To get started, we need to have an analytical model for jitters. So we have a perfect clock here, A cosine omega CT, and then we have a corrupted clock where some of the edges are moved early and late, and we do this by adding in a variable to the argument of the cosine, phi of T. That's the phase modulation term. If we plot just phi of t by itself, that's that mythical semi-continuous jitter term that I showed on a previous slide. So we can then analyze the loop in terms of transfer functions on just phi of t. So let's go to a simple linear loop. Here we introduce the models of the various loop components. We have a phase detector, which takes an input phase and a phase from the VCO, compares them and produces some kind of a, let's assume here, an analog voltage, which is proportional to the phase error. And it has a gain, K phi, which is volts per radian. That then goes into some kind of a loop filter, which typically will be a pole and a zero to stabilize the loop, and into the VCO. The VCO has two terms. The output of the loop actually controls the frequency of the VCO, but because this is a phase-locked loop, when we analyze the loop, we need to compare phase with phase, so you have to add this extra integration in. So if you've ever stabilized a negative feedback loop or done loop stability on an op-amp, this is all the same mathematics. However, in a phase-locked loop, you have this extra integration which you can't get rid of and which doesn't exist in an op-amp. So all the tricks of making a phase-locked loop work is basically just tricks of dealing with that extra integral that you can't get around, which is built into the VCO. To analyze a feedback loop, it's generally helpful to look at the open loop transfer function. And so what I've done here is broken the loop at A, or broken the loop at this point marked X, and then I'm able to look at the open loop gain from A to C. That's this red line. And in most loops, you have this single pole, which is the VCO itself, and then it will go second order here. That's how you get a high DC gain to have low tracking phase tracking error, and that comes from the integral in this loop transfer function. But then, if you're familiar with Bode plots and stability theory, the open loop gain must get back to single pole a decade before it crosses through the 0 dB line. So we have to put a zero in the loop to let this flatten out again. And so this is what a typical open loop gain would look like. When we close the loop, we can then talk about the transfer function from A to C and the transfer function from B to C. The transfer function from A to C will be equal to the jitter transfer function, just like in the Sonnet specification. And it looks like this blue line, that's C divided by A, and you can see that just like the Sonnet transfer function, it's very close to 0 dB. It might have a small amount of peaking, and then it's single pole roll-off. So in most cases, the Sonnet transfer function would specify this breakpoint to be at around 2 megahertz for, say, a 2.5 gigabit per second system. Now, another thing that's quite interesting is how does VCO phase noise appear in this? Because all practical monolithic oscillators are going to have a pretty high phase noise. So we can look at the transfer function from B to C, and we get this green line. What we find out is that phase noise inside the loop bandwidth is attenuated by the excess loop gain, and outside the loop bandwidth becomes unity gain. Most oscillators, well, in specific, ring oscillators fall off single pole, 20 dB per decade, and that's due to integration of the Gaussian random phase noise of each gate as it goes around and around again. That gives you the single pole roll-off. And most ring oscillators, if you design them at a high enough power level, are going to have a phase noise that becomes negligible at 1 or 2 megahertz. So with an on-chip oscillator, you still can have a very good system phase noise if you make sure that the open loop phase noise of the ring oscillator is only significant within the loop bandwidth where it's suppressed. Okay, I'm just going to sort of quickly go through some of the components and not dwell on them in much detail. In a loop, you always have to have a decision circuit, and this is typically just a D-latch, which has been optimized for low hysteresis and high input sensitivity. Oops. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the master-slave latch, track and hold, and you can do it in CMOS just as well. Often sense amplifiers are used, and many clever optimizations are possible. As far as VCOs, many possibilities again. LC oscillator, multivibrator, and ring oscillator. I won't go through much of the details. However, the ring oscillator has a unique advantage in that it makes it very easy to produce very precise multi-phase signals. So when you get up to these high-performance systems, where you need to make a multi-phase system and use multiple latches in a round-robin fashion to get around the regeneration time of the latch. In those trend lines, all of the high-performance systems were using 4 or 8 phases to get up to the highest performance in the process. You need multi-phase clocks to drive all those latches, and a ring oscillator does a really good job of that. Multivibrator was common at lower speeds. It tends not to be used at higher speeds. One thing, observation I'd like to make about a multivibrator is that this is really two amplifiers just connected in a ring, and when you add an extra pole to that, it actually doesn't even have to oscillate. There might not be enough excess phase shift to oscillate, and typically what makes a multivibrator oscillate is that it has a nonlinearity in it. So there's a time lag when it's switched in one state that the capacitor has to charge before it switches the other state. It's that extra time lag due to the nonlinearity that makes it intrinsically oscillatory. You can really only get that extra nonlinearity if you're operating at a low enough frequency to where you have extra FT available to have some extra harmonics in the waveform. If you want a sharp nonlinearity, you need a bunch of harmonics. And so this kind of a circuit tends to die when you get at very high frequencies because you just don't have any harmonics left and it stops oscillating. You can't get the Schmidt trigger action anymore. So to get around that, it's become more common for people to use ring oscillators, and this is a typical one, sort of the genre. In this one, we have an interpolator here shown schematically as a potentiometer and shown in a circuit diagram down here. When the interpolator is tuned all the way to the upper input, this becomes a three-element oscillator and oscillates at a fairly high frequency, 1/6 gate delays. If you tune the potentiometer down to the bottom, it becomes a five-element oscillator and operates 5/3 slower at the 1/10 gate delays. At any intermediate point, you can look at input 1 and input 2. They're, of course, at the same frequency, but there'll be different phase shifts. So on this phasor diagram, the potentiometer tunes between those two points and produces an intermediate phase and hence an intermediate frequency. So you get linear tuning over a wide range, and it can be tuned quite rapidly. Now, in all of these monolithic designs, especially when you have something like a ring oscillator that has maybe more than an octave tuning range, it's possible to get false locking of the phase lock loop. So I want to mention the problem and some of the ways that it's eliminated. If you have data coming in and you have a clock at the correct frequency, you can see that every edge of the clock gets compared to the proper location of the data, and you get a very consistent phase detection feedback. However, if the clock were to run at exactly half the frequency, the edges of a half-frequency clock fall at just every other edge of the regular clock, so those are also going to be correctly lined up, and the loop will also lock there too. Same way, if the VCO is running at exactly twice the frequency, they'll still align correctly with the data. And oddly enough, if you have a VCO at any rational ratio of the data frequency, in this case I've shown 4/3, you also can get a false lock. So let me zoom in on this little area shown in the oval. Here I show 5 cycles of the clock, and these 4 vertical lines show the possible locations of data transitions. The first one is correct. It falls on the correct edge. The last one is correct. So basically, here's the 4/3 relationship, 4 clock cycles and 3 data cycles. The 2 middle ones, this second one is always early, and the third one is always late. These two will cancel in the loop filter and have no net effect. However, the correct feedback from every fourth one will make it, it's a slightly weaker feedback signal, but it will cause the loop to lock there. So you can think of this in terms of an energy diagram that has a very deep minimum. This is the correct lock point. The false lock points are like little bumps on this diagram, and they occur at all the rational ratios. They're the same thing that you see when you're driving down the car and you look at a bunch of trees in the field and you see all those various interesting symmetry points. Those are all the rational ratios of the stakes lining up at different angles. And so some way you have to get around this problem and make sure that the loop can never get far enough away to get to one of these stable lock points. The correct lock point is a very deep point and has a pull-in range, maybe 5-10% around it. So really, you only need to get the clock within a couple hundred ppm or so, and then you don't have to worry about these anymore. In a lot of the circuits that we design, if the denominator is bigger than 7, we found that our loops will always pull into the correct point. So we're really interested in 5/6, 4/3, those kind of low integer ratios. So one way to get around this is to build a phase detector and a frequency detector, and you can look in the literature, you can do frequency detectors with rotational detectors that look at the beat between the data edges arriving with an I and Q clock and look at whether it rotates clockwise or counterclockwise. This can help quite a bit. However, I want to point out that it's a tricky task because the data is stuttering. The fact that there are not edges every time is what is the data that you desire to transmit. This means that the phase in a rotational detector is not Nyquist sampled. There are regions where there is no information that may actually rotate a couple times before it gets another sample. So this can make the lock range a little bit wider, but it's still subject to false lock if the VCO range is too wide. So what people tend to be doing to get around this are one of two techniques. This is probably an earlier one that people did in bipolar because the gate count is small. This is where we have a phase detector for locking to data, stuttering data, and we have a frequency detector for locking to a reference clock, which is provided by a crystal, and a little state machine that's able to tell whether there is data on the input and whether the input is locked, and it can tell whether the frequency detector is locked. If the data detector is not locked, then what we do is we switch to the frequency detector and lock in a deterministic way with a wide-range frequency detector to a crystal. Once we've decided that we've stably frequency locked, we then switch back to the frequency detector, and we're close enough to where you don't have to worry about a false acquisition. Now that people have moved to CMOS implementations, it's becoming more common for people to just build something that's essentially a little frequency counter, and you just count the frequency of the VCO, and if it's outside of 100 ppm range, you inject current into the charge pump to just, it's like a sheep herder, keeps the sheep always, you know, on track, keeps the VCO always within the tolerance, so that when the data comes on, it's always within the pull-in range. In terms of phase detectors, this is the block that needs to develop a voltage or some feedback signal that tells you whether your early or late, or tells you what the phase error in the loop is. There's two basic kinds. You can either have a continuous analog phase detector in which you have a voltage or a current or a pulse width proportional to the phase error, or you can have something which just tells you you're early or you're late. Binary quantized, sometimes called bang-bang or early-late phase detector. Let's look at one of the linear phase detectors. This one's quite commonly used. It's called a Hoagie or a Hogg. Never met the fellow, so I don't really know how to pronounce his name, H-O-G-G-E. The way it works is you take the analog data coming in and you run it through a retiming latch. And normally the retiming latch is in the middle of the eye so that the propagation delay through the latch, it's going to be cleaned up and nice and square, but it'll be one half of a bit time under the nominal conditions because it samples halfway in the middle of the bit. So if you took the analog data and XORed it with the output of this latch, you'd get a little narrow pulse, a one half bit width pulse for every data transition. If we then took the opposite edge of the clock and ran it through another latch, we would have precise half-bit delay here, which would phase lag it. So this down signal is here. This is always a fixed width equal to the clock, one-half the clock period. This is a variable width, which varies as the data moves back and forth with respect to the clock. So if we took both of these and low-pass filtered them and then ran them into a differencing circuit, If the clock got a little bit early, these pulses would get narrower than these pulses, and the net result would be that the charge pump would charge up. If the clock gets late, this pulse will get fatter than this one, and then that will cause the system to charge down. There's a couple problems with this, which makes it very hard to operate at a very high frequency. One is that this data waveform may vary in amplitude because the limiting amplifier may not have fully saturated it. The rise times may be different here than there, which causes an asymmetry in this op-amp. Another problem is that these pulses are nominally one half of a bit width. That means that they're running faster than a latch, for instance, the latch on your transmitter that's trying to make pulses, bit pulses on the output multiplexer. So it's possible that these half-width pulses become the frequency-limiting element in the entire block diagram for the link. Especially if the data actually slides around in phase, these pulses will have to get smaller than a half-width pulse, maybe quarter and eighth width of a pulse. That means you need a lot of FT to support those narrow pulses. The last problem with this is that the gain going into the loop is dependent on the transition density. And so you've carefully crafted your open loop gain, and it's being modulated up and down in a random fashion by the data characteristics. So that means you have to over-design your loop such that it's stable under the worst case variations in transition density. To get around some of these problems, the early-late phase detector was developed. It was first proposed by Alexander in 1975 and became commonly used in the early 90s. As a way to build monolithic implementations that scale very well to high frequencies. In this structure, we have two latches, one which is used as a retiming latch and one which is used as a phase detection latch. The data retiming latch is sampled on the rising edge of the clock, and the phase detection latch is sampled on the falling edge of the clock so that you have this diagram. This is a shift register so that bit A comes out here, bit B comes out here, the transition sample T is sampled right there. From these three samples, the two bits and the transition, you can detect whether the VCO is too fast, too slow, and whether or not there was a transition in the data that gave you some information, or whether you should just hold the VCO at the same frequency that it had previously. So, for instance, if A is a 0 and B is a 1, we know we had a rising edge. That falls to this case here. If the T sample is a 0, that means that it fell on the A side of the transition and the VCO is too early. If the T sample is a 1, it means it fell on the right side of the transition and the VCO is late. And you can work through this table and see that you can fill it in for both rising and falling edges. If, on the other hand, we're in the middle of a run length so that A and B are both 1, then we basically ignore the T transition and we just tri-state the charge pump and let the VCO stay at the last frequency that it ran at. We make no corrections when there are no transitions. Okay, This slide may be a little bit hard to understand. Maybe we'll come back to it after we've discussed bang bang loops in a little bit more detail. But it's possible to build one of these binary quantized phase detectors in which you don't do tri-stating. In other words, when you go into a long run length, you continue to tell the VCO to charge up, or the charge pump to charge up or to charge down. You don't do a tri-state function. Then what would happen is when this is a close-up of this waveform. So this is the phase of the retiming clock, and this is time going along here. In a tri-stated loop, you either ramp the VCO up or down, and when there's a long run length, you just hold. You don't change anything at all. If you didn't do that, then during a long run length, you would continue to charge, and you'd have a very high jitter in the loop. So you can get away with this in something like an 8B, 10B code that only has a 5-bit run length. Your hunting jitter would be 5 times the nominal amount. But in something like a Sonnet system, you basically have to use a tri-stated charge pump. This will make sense later on after we talk about bang-bang loops. Loop filters, basically you need a mechanism for charging up and down a capacitor based on early-late indications, and ideally you want some way to tri-state it. In this case, we have an up and a down, and when they fight each other, the capacitor neither charges nor discharges. One thing to point out here is that people have, in bang-bang loops, made charge pumps using up-down counters, because basically you want to count how many early and late, and that controls the center frequency of the VCO with the DAC. But if you do that, you have to really be careful that that up-down counter never gets a metastable event. If it ever gets a metastable event, it will lose its count, and you'll have a horrendous burst of errors. So practically, most of the monolithic implementations are using analog charge pumps, in which case, if you have a metastable event coming in from your phase detector, it doesn't matter. It's just on the boundary anyway. Okay, so now I'd like to go into bang-bang loop theory. And I've already talked a bit about this. The first point is, why would you want to do this? It turns out that if you put one of these early-late detectors inside a loop, there's a feedback system theorem that says if you put a hard nonlinearity in a feedback system, the loop is intrinsically oscillatory. It has no steady-state solution. So you go, why would I want to do this thing which makes my system oscillatory and makes it really hard to design? And it comes down to what I've already talked about. If you do it this way with the linear system, it's very hard to stay lined up in the middle of the eye because of the different prop delays in the clock recovery path. So this tends to not work up at the highest speed of the process. The narrow pulses of linear phase detectors may not be supportable unless you have a lot of excess FT. In the bang-bang system, even the clock to Q of the retiming latch, the clock to Q is compensated by the clock to Q of the phase detector latch, so that you are going to be very precisely matched. And if you use a ring oscillator which has layout symmetry, then you know that the duty cycle by layout symmetry is going to be 50%, so that the rising edge is exactly 180 degrees from the falling edge. So you can run these things at quite high speeds. So it's not just me saying this, but this is a graph of CDR phase-like loop design style over time, and these are all the clock and data recovery circuits that have been published in this ISSCC proceedings from 1988 until the present. And what I'm graphing on the y-axis is the ratio of the link bit rate to the effective FT of the process in which the links were implemented. So this is a measure of how close to the capacity of the process the designers were able to achieve. And so what you see is that the linear phase-like loops were common practice prior to 1990 and still are occasionally used in maybe silicon, germanium, and processes that have really low integration density, where you just want to do basically a differentiate and rectify and then publish the world's fastest CDR at 50 gigabits or something, but in really low integration processes. But when you look at what has been practiced 1998 to 2002, you see that this whole upper corner is all done with bang-bang loop designs, and they're approaching 0.4 to 0.6 of FT bitrate. Also, you can see that all the leading points here are using 8-phase, 2-phase, 4-phase, 4-phase, and 10-phase. So the two techniques are using bang-bang loops and using multi-phase sampling systems on the receiver so that you don't have to worry about the regeneration time of the latch limiting you. So let's analyze Bang Loop system and try to build a set of insights and design equations which would allow us to build a Bang Loop in a rational fashion. So the simplest Bang Loop is a first-order Bang Loop, and it turns out that if you're not locking to data, but you're locking to a clock, then just a latch makes a good phase detector, just like this. Here on the right, I show a single rising transition and two possible clock phases. So here I have a square wave coming in, and I'm using the VCO to sample it at the same frequency. If the VCO gets a little bit early, I sample a zero. If the VCO gets a little late, I sample one. So I've got early-late already built in. Don't have to worry about all the ATB business for the simple case. In this diagram, the tuning voltage of the VCO is driven by two binary signals, a 0 or 1 coming out of the latch, and it causes the VCO to run at two discrete frequencies, F nominal plus or minus F bang bang, the bang bang delta F. The phase error of the phase detector is evaluated at discrete time intervals T update, which is basically one VCO period. Typically, the VCO is only modulated by about one part in 500, so a precise analysis would let this update time be variable, so you'd have a non-uniform time system. But for most practical systems, you can just assume that T update is a fixed number. So if we want to simulate this loop, and I'm going to show some graphs in the next couple slides, we need to find a way to do it that doesn't take forever. If you run SPICE and actually try to do a VCO and simulate the waveforms, you have to have a picosecond time step, and it just takes forever. And you can take hours and hours just to get an acquisition transient. So we make the observation that we don't need to simulate the VCO waveform to accurately model ideal PLL behavior. We're really only interested in changes on the order of the time constant of the loop filter. We don't need to simulate the picosecond behavior. So we're only going to model frequency and phase, and we're going to model them as voltages. All the state variables get modeled as voltages, and we'll convert between frequency and phase variables with explicit integrator blocks. This can speed up your simulation to where a full acquisition transient is less than a second on a PC. So basically, I rearrange the simple block diagram in the following way. I take the VCO, which has a 1 over S, or an integral in it, and I tear it into two pieces, and I pull that integrator around to the input here. And so now my input is not a phase, it's a frequency. This is convenient because I can then simulate a step in frequency, a frequency acquisition transient, very simply, just by putting a step here on my simulation. And the output of the VCO is not a time waveform, it's just a voltage. So this in my simulator is just an amplifier that gets the tuning voltage on the input, amplifies it up to 2.5 gigavolts, plus or minus some delta, comes around here and subtracts from the input voltage, giving symbolically a delta F, which is 510 volts, 510 megahertz. I then integrate that so that at this point here, I have the phase error in the loop, delta theta 1. A nice thing about tearing it apart in this way is that I can simulate frequency steps here, and I can simulate sinusoidal or steps in phase here. I have phase and frequency decoupled. So that finally, at the output of the summer, I have the phase error as seen by the quantizer, which then simply decides whether this voltage, symbolically this phase, is early or late, and then produces a binary quantized voltage to go to the VCO. So you might want to put a paper clip or stick your finger in this page, because these variables are what I'm going to use to label the next couple slides. So we'll refer back to this. So for a first order loop, what I've done here is on the upper graph in red, I'm showing the instantaneous frequency of the VCO, and you can see it's toggling between F nominal minus F bang bang and F nominal plus F bang bang. And in blue, I'm showing an input frequency which is slewing across the VCO lock range in discrete steps. And when the input frequency is outside of the range of the VCO's capability to toggle back and forth, the loop is out of lock. And you can see here, this on the lower graph, this is the phase error versus time. the loop is in cycle slipping. It's jumping back and forth between plus and minus 180 degrees as it's just slipping. As soon as the input frequency gets within the range in which the VCO can toggle back and forth, what happens is the VCO is then able to spend a certain fraction of time at the high frequency and a certain fraction of time at the low frequency such that the average phase is correct. And then over this range, the jitter is bounded and has a hunting jitter equal to JPP, which we'll calculate in another couple slides. If we zoom in on just the lock range region, you can see that when the input frequency is near the low end of the VCO range, the VCO spends nearly all of its time at the lowest possible frequency, but then gradually walks out of the correct phase until it crosses 0 degrees, and then it very briefly switches to the high frequency, causing the phase to suddenly jump down by JPP, the bang-bang loop intrinsic hunting jitter, or sometimes I call that bang-bang delta T, if you express it in terms of time or picoseconds. As you go towards the higher frequency, you'll see when it gets up here, it's spending most of its time at the high frequency. When it's in the middle, the loop is spending 50% of the time at both frequencies, and it's able to track the phase just fine that way. We can see that the phase detector duty cycle appears to be proportional to the average frequency error in the loop. So now let's put some jitter on the signal. And what I'm going to do is inject a sine wave into that phi mod port in the loop. And then we're going to see the loop try to track that out. And so what I've done is I've set the input frequency very close to the lower limit of the range so that I can then introduce a phase modulation. The loop is trying to track this by hunting up and down in phase. If the phase modulation gets too high, then the effective frequency, which is the static input frequency plus the integral of this term, to cut through the range of the loop, then the loop can't slew in phase fast enough to keep up with the phase modulation. So it falls out of oscillation here, and you get slew rate limiting. And you can tell that because the phase detector went static. It's basically staying in one state, speeding up as fast as it can. It still can't get there. This causes a sampling error. The difference between these two signals is an error which is seen by the phase detector and could potentially cause the sampling point to move around in the eye diagram and cause a bit error. So this is the loop not working. So we can summarize the first order loop with some design equations. It has a lock range. If the input frequency FC is greater than F nominal minus F bang bang, the loop is locked. And what I mean by FC is the static frequency plus any frequency shift due to phase modulation. If it's less than F nominal minus F bang bang, it's in lock. If you're within the range, you're in lock. The jitter peaking is, or the jitter in peak-to-peak in unit intervals is how much the jitter, the phase moves within one unit interval. And that's 2 times T update times F bang bang. The bang bang loop tracking is slew rate limited. The effective loop bandwidth is amplitude dependent. So if you have a very low frequency jitter signal, the slew rate in the phase domain is fairly small and the loop can track it just fine. If you have a high frequency jitter signal, you have to drop the amplitude to keep the slew rate small. So the loop is going to go in slew rate limiting at higher and higher frequencies as you make the jitter amplitude smaller and smaller. The maximum amount of phase modulation at frequency F mod before you go into slew rate limiting, this is sort of the brittle point at which the loop fails, in unit intervals is F bang bang divided by F mod, the modulation frequency. Now, if the loop is locked, we already made the observation that the instantaneous duty cycle is proportional to the frequency error. So we can calculate that more precisely here. If the loop is locked, the duty cycle C, the amount of time the loop spends percentage-wise at the high frequency, C, and the time it spends at the low frequency, 1 minus C, has to give an average frequency which is equal to the input frequency. So FC has to equal F nominal plus delta F, the average frequency error. And that has to be created by spending a percentage of time C at F nominal plus bang bang, and a percentage of time 1 minus C at F nominal minus F bang bang. If you solve this equation for C, the duty cycle, you find it's equal to 1 half, so that if there's no frequency error, the duty cycle is exactly 1 half. And if there's a frequency error of delta F, you get a variation in the duty cycle of delta F over 2 times F bang bang. So the phase detector average duty cycle is proportional to delta F in a very rigorous way. Later on, you'll see in an analysis that this is this obeys a delta sigma law. So the observations here are that jitter generation, jitter transfer bandwidth, jitter tolerance, and the frequency lock range are all very inconveniently controlled by a single parameter, F bang bang. If I want to make it have a better tracking range, I have to increase the frequency modulation of the VCO, which causes the phase walk-off to be bigger. I have no way to control those independently. However, the phase detector average duty cycle is proportional to the frequency error. So here's the strategy. Use the average duty cycle out of the phase detector to control the loop center frequency. It's kind of like having a grad student sitting looking at the phase detector output and adjusting the little trim pot to keep it 50%. If you do this, then it decouples the lock range from the jitter tolerance and jitter generation. So I can make the hunting jitter very small, but it has a very small lock range. But then by having a second order loop looking at the duty cycle and keeping it set to 50%, I can track the input signal as long as it slowly varies over gigahertz range. If the center frequency control loop is slow enough, the resulting loop behavior will be very, very similar to a first order loop, simple to analyze, simple to understand, but with a very wide extended lock range. So this leads us to the black diagram of a second order bang bang loop, which in practice is what everyone uses for monolithic implementation. Here we have the first order loop, which I described before, where we take the output of the phase detector and we attenuate it by a factor of beta, so that it only causes a very small tuning modulation of the VCO. We then have a second loop, which I call the integral branch, which looks at the duty cycle, the long-term average of the phase detector output, and develops a wide-range tuning voltage to keep the VCO centered, so that if this duty cycle ever becomes non-50%, this integrator will develop an error voltage and drive the VCO center frequency to recenter the first-order bang-bang loop. Now, it turns out that because this VCO has an integrator in it already, if you had two integrators in the loop without this zero, effectively, it would oscillate badly. And in fact, it only works well when the dynamics are dominated by purely the first-order loop. So what we want to do then is come up with a design parameter which tells us to what extent the first-order loop is dominating over the second-order loop. And we call it the stability factor. And we can go through that analysis here. If you look at this little diagram, the first graph is the step in voltage, V phi, coming out of the phase detector, which leads to a step in frequency in the bang-bang path, which is V phi beta kV, the VCO gain times the attenuator factor times the voltage coming out of the phase detector. The phase error coming out of the VCO due to the bang-bang path is then V phi beta kVt. It's the first order integral of this step change in frequency. If we do the same analysis for the integral branch, we get a ramp coming out of this integrator, and we get a quadratic phase term due to the integral branch coming back to the phase detector. For this loop to be stable and to work properly, we need to make sure that this lower change in blue, V phi kV t squared over 2 tau, is small compared to the bang bang phase change, V phi beta kV t. So the next slide takes a ratio of those two phase modulation effects at one update time. The linear term and the quadratic term. The loop is only stable if the linear term dominates. So we take the ratio of these two and call it the stability factor. And it's numerically equal to 2 beta tau over t update. So the loop gets more stable if you decrease the attenuation factor, which increases the frequency modulation of the VCO, or if you make the charge pump have a bigger time constant, or if you can figure out how to get higher phase detection density, more rapid phase update. So I want to show some simulations of the second order loop and show how it tracks and responds to step changes. And to do that, I'm going to redraw it in a similar way that I redrew the first order loop. So here we have the proportional contribution drawn in blue and the integral contribution drawn in red. And what I'm going to do is take the contribution of the bang-bang path, the proportional path, which is beta, kv, and an integral, and I'm going to redraw it as this little inner loop. The rule of block diagram algebra is that you can factor anything around as long as you don't cross a nonlinearity. So this used to go from this side of that quantizer to that side, and it's okay if I just abstract it mathematically and jump it across quickly. This is nice because what I have then is an embedded first-order loop which has the frequency error taken out by a surrounding second-order loop. And just like you kept your fingers in that first page of definitions for the first-order loop, you might want to keep your finger in for this page because these symbols are how I'm going to label the upcoming simulations. So first thing is to look at a step change in frequency. So what I've done in red here on the first graph is I make an instantaneous step in frequency on the input. The second order loop contribution is drawn in green, and it has a very slow response because it's a linear system at that point. The embedded bang-bang loop acts as a unity gain frequency detector, and then the second order loop is a first order tracking loop. So what happens is because the frequency error is taken out slowly, there's a residual error term, which is kind of this little inner triangle. That causes a change in loop phase, as seen by the bang-bang loop, called delta theta 1 here. The green line tries to track out that phase here, leading to the difference of the two, delta theta 3, this blue line. And so what's curious is that although there was an instantaneous step in VCO frequency, there's no accumulation of phase error in the bang-bang loop. Because of the very aggressive jitter tracking, we don't have a phase accumulation. Now, there have been papers published which have made the statement that it's not good to use a phase lock loop for clock recovery in high-density systems because if you ever get a power supply step, the linear loop is going to have a step change in frequency and it's going to track it out slowly, which will cause a big glitch in phase, which will be very slow for the loop to take out. So the conclusion is that you should use delay lock loops because they don't have the second order jitter accumulation. However, if you use a bang-bang loop, you get the advantage of a delay lock loop, but you don't have to suffer some of the other problems of a delay lock loop, which is what happens with the last phase and the jitter sensitivity that you get on that last phase with the next incoming phase. If you're interested in that, I'll describe it in the questions afterwards. The key thing here is that if you make sure that the worst case power supply step of the VCO falls within F nominal plus and minus F bang bang, falls within the bang bang delta F range, the bang bang loop will just make an instantaneous change in duty cycle and you will see no phase glitch outside of the normal hunting jitter. So it's very tolerant to power supply noise. This is in contrast to normal linear loop theory. Okay, if you do have a power supply step which causes a VCO step in frequency which is too large, it does get brittle, so you have to be careful to design this. Here I've made a large step in red, and the second order loop is trying to track it, and the residual error produces a phase glitch, delta theta 1, and in green here, you can see the bang-bang loop going into slew rate limiting. It can't catch up until this point right here. And that it can be seen clearly in the output of the phase detector where it stays in one state, desperately trying to catch up, but it doesn't have enough frequency range to do so. Then the difference between this red signal, delta theta 1, and the green signal, theta BB, produces an integrated phase error, delta theta 3, and you get a large error in the sampling point of the loop, which could cause a bit error. So practically, you want to make sure that you've designed your system such that it can never get into this regime. Similar things with sinusoidal inputs, so we're interested in seeing how we meet the Sonnet jitter specs. If we put in a sinusoidal modulation, delta theta 1, green, phi mod, the frequency loop will track it with the reduced bandwidth as delta theta 1, and the difference between the green and red term gives you this blue term, delta theta 2, which I've reproduced on the second graph and shown it being tracked by the bang bang loop in red. And the difference between what was left over from the second order loop and what the bang bang tracked is this green line. It's just uniform jitter at the bang bang loop hunting jitter amount. And you can see that as the phase modulates up and down, effectively modulating the frequency up and down within the range of the VCO, the duty cycle of the phase detector is sinusoidally varying back and forth. Now, if we were to increase the input phase modulation even more, then what's going to happen is the residual jitter in the loop will become too much for the bang bang to track. So this red line can't keep up with this blue line. And what you'll get is a residual sampling error at the sampling latch, shown in green, a little quadratic blip. And you can tell that by seeing that the duty cycle of the phase detector has gone into saturation. I don't show here a circuit, but it is possible, and I've simulated putting a little shift register on the output of the phase detector. And you can then look to make sure that it's nicely oscillating with a pseudo-random signal. And if it's not oscillating, you could increase the bang-bang delta F dynamically, which is very much like adaptive ADPCM codec. And you can make it have tremendous jitter tracking capability. But typically, people don't do that. It's possible to set all these parameters up to where, with a simple first-order loop, you can meet Sonnet specs. So another insight into this loop, we talked about the duty cycle being proportional to instantaneous frequency. It turns out that it's actually proportional in a way which is analogous to a delta sigma modulator. And you can see that by taking the loop diagram and mathematically rearranging it with block diagram algebra. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the integral in this feedback path and the integral here that's converting from frequency to phase, and I'm going to suck those two integrals through this summer. So we end up with that integral here, and I'm going to substitute beta kV V phi for FBB. So we go from that block diagram to this block diagram, and this is the classic first order delta sigma modulator. And so the input here is delta F. The output is an analog stream, which is unity gain equal to delta F, with an FBB scale factor, which has an additive noise term due to the quantization error of this latch. So in delta sigma theory, there's a nice paper here by Max Hauser that was in the Analog Engineering Society Journal, which is a really good tutorial on delta sigma, very, very readable. This came from his paper. To a pretty good approximation, you can replace in a first-order system the quantizer by a simple summer. So you can assume that this whole block is unity gain, and that what happens is there's simply a quantization noise that's added in here due to the round-off error of the latch. And then we can analyze the transfer function from x to y and from q to z. From y of z equals this transfer function times the input, which is basically unity gain and then rolls off. So the bang bang loop acts as an embedded frequency detector with a finite bandwidth. But the quantization noise gets frequency shaped first order like this, so that most of the noise occurs at high frequencies. Unfortunately, in the loop, we're going to use it as a phase detector, which then multiplies that by a single pole roll-off, so this becomes a flat noise term when we actually look at its contribution in the phase-lock loop. So with some of these insights, we can then try to solve for slope overload. Remember, there was an internal sort of unigain frequency detector and then an outer loop. The system is going to go into slew rate limiting whenever the residual frequency error from the outer loop is greater than the ability of the quantizer to quantize it, and the quantizer is plus and minus FBB. So when FBB is less than delta F, the loop will go into slew rate limiting. And if you draw this out in the S domain with these substitutions here, you can come up with this expression. And this is the maximum input phase modulation in unit intervals normalized to the intrinsic hunting jitter of the loop, S squared plus S over plus 2 over the stability factor divided by S cubed plus S squared. So you can use this analytic term to compute jitter tolerance for design in a spreadsheet or whatnot. Graphically, it looks like this. It's a little bit complicated. when you normalize everything, you find that there's really only two parameters that characterize a bang-bang loop, and that's the stability factor and FBB. When you will take jitters and normalize them by the update time so that they become unitless, and when you're interested, for instance, in a maximum input jitter, you also normalize it by the intrinsic bang-bang hunting time so that everything becomes unitless. So what you find is that if you have a very high loop stability so that for high frequencies the loop is acting very much like a first-order loop, then as the input jitter goes down in frequency, you can tolerate more amplitude, and it goes up as a single pulse. So it's decade per decade trade-off. At some point, the second-order portion of the loop starts to track also, and this becomes second-order, which means as you go to even lower frequencies, you can tolerate second-order growth in jitter amplitude. And as you decrease the loop stability, you find that it goes second-order even earlier. And in fact, these points, I just plotted them for interest. In a practical system, you'd want to keep the stability up at least around 100. And these would probably be oscillatory systems. So in principle, actually I've done it, you can take the Sonnet specification, and once you've decided on an update time, that's basically the data rate of the Sonnet system, and you've decided on a F bang bang for your loop, so you can compute a delta theta bang bang knowing the update time, you can then graph on here the Sonnet jitter tolerance spec and then see what stability you need to meet it. Okay, the other question that comes up is jitter generation for the loop and how to compute what the jitter generation is. Using the delta sigma approximation, we basically can take the phase detector out of the loop and replace it by unity gain. And then what we do is we have to inject into the loop a quantization noise term, which is equal to the roundoff error of the latch. And you end up with a loop equation that looks like this. You have a source phase noise, which is the clock quality coming from your bit error rate tester. You have a bang-bang phase noise that gets injected here, and you have perhaps a characterized VCO open loop phase noise that you want to see. You want to look at the suppression of the loop. And here's some actual simulated and measured data for a bang-bang system, WSY97, with these parameters. So these are the loop transfer, closed loop transfer functions. This is the jitter transfer curve, just due to the linear loop analysis. This is the VCO phase noise rejection curve. So these are just the various points in the loop equation. And then what I'm going to do is take the VCO phase noise in dBc per hertz. I'm going to take the injected bang-bang phase noise shown here, which is sine x over x, and actually follows this kind of roll-off. It's basically flat within the loop bandwidth. And then this funny blue line here in the middle graph is the phase noise of the synthesizer which drove our BERT. So it has 90 dBc per unit hertz down here at 10 kilohertz. What I then do is take the source phase noise and multiply it by this red mask. I take the bang-bang phase noise, multiply it by the red mask, take the VCO phase noise, multiply it by the green mask, and with the script, I sum all those contributions in an RMS way, basically sum the power, convert it back into a spectrum, RMS, and I get the green as measured phase noise with the spectrum analyzer on an actual IC, and the red is the computed phase noise. So this allows you to verify that you'll meet the Sonnet jitter generation specs in an analytical way using a bang-bang phase lock loop. One of the last graphs I want to show here is we've talked about how the loop behaves with sinusoidal jitter modulation and with steps. The question comes up, what would happen if we had Gaussian phase noise coming in? Deterministic jitter can often be modeled, and actually jitter of a scrambled code going through a coupling capacitor can be modeled as a Gaussian. And what you find is, this again is normalized, so I have the RMS input jitter, which is normalized by the intrinsic hunting jitter of the loop, scale factor of the loop, and I have the output jitter normalized to the bang-bang hunting jitter. And what you find is that when the input jitter is basically zero, very small, the output is just the jitter generation, which is described by a first-order loop. When the jitter starts to go up, for very low stability loops, there's a certain point at which when the input jitter equals the hunting jitter, you just go on a linear graph. That's because with very low stability factors, the loop is basically quadratically oscillating all over the place, and it just hunts to the limits of the distribution, so that it just follows the input statistical distribution with very little attenuation. So low stability factor loops do this, just linear. When you go to high stability loops, and they all plot on top of each other here, because for loop stabilities greater than 1, you get a hunting jitter theta BB of 1, because the quadratic term basically goes to 0 and you just get the intrinsic first-order hunting. What you see is that there's a very interesting region here where it goes as the square root of the input jitter. So if you have a normalized input jitter of 100, the output jitter is 10. So it actually, the output jitter is the square root of the input jitter. Why is that? Well, in statistics, there's something called random walk or drunkard's walk. So if you start a drunkard at a flagpole or a street light, and he flips a coin, or actually he's just drunk, so he takes a random step in this direction and then a random step in that direction, every time uniform random. The analysis says that after n steps, you will expect him, he will have a mean a distance from the flagpole of square root of n steps. So this random walk statistic actually aggregates in a square root fashion. And so what happens when you have high Gaussian jitter is that it basically overrides the bang-bang of the loop and causes the loop to make a random choice to hunt up or hunt down. And the amount that it walks off then becomes a random walk. However, it's a biased random walk because the further off you get, the more the chances are of the loop to control its own destiny. So it basically stays bounded by square root of n, where n has something to do with the loop bandwidth. So you can decompose this into these three terms, an idle term, a linear term, and a walk term, and the total jitter is empirically found to be the sum of those three terms. Okay, so this is trying to summarize everything up into a single flowchart. You decided you want to use a bang-bang loop, so you first decide whether you're using a run-length limited code, 8B10B, or a scrambled code that's not run-length limited. If it's a run-length limited code, you have the option of not using a tri-stated charge pump, in which case you would set your update time to the maximum run length to do a worst-case design. If, on the other hand, you're using a code without a limited run length, then what you want to do is set the update time equal to t-bit, and you want to make sure you're using a tri-stated charge pump. Then, once you've made that decision, you compute beta, which is the attenuation factor into the VCO, which sets your plus or minus f-bang-bang, what the modulation of the VCO is. Based on the VCO gain, the phase detector output voltage, and the update time, such that you meet the jitter generation specs, that the hunting jitter falls within the allowable jitter generation. Once you've done that, then you need to check to make sure that that beta with these terms will give you the proper jitter tolerance. There's a direct trade-off between jitter generation and jitter tolerance. That's why you don't want to make jitter generation go to zero, because you won't have any jitter tracking tolerance. So you have to do a trade-off between these to where you satisfy both specifications, which is possible in Sonnet. After you've done that, you then need to set the loop filter time constant tau such that you've satisfied the loop stability and the system acts as a first-order loop with only a small second-order control. And tau is then given by 2 beta over the quantity t update times the stability factor. And typically, you'll want to make this in the range of 100 to 10,000 or even higher, depending on how high of a hold capacitor you can build for your charge pump. There are advantages for having even higher stability. For instance, in the Gaussian jitter transfer graph, the previous graph, you stay in that square root region of jitter transfer for a much longer time if you have higher jitter stability factors. Yeah. Okay, so in summary, it's a lot of complexity for just trying to get something which is time aligned and doesn't require a high FT. But I think that with the design graphs and the insights that I've shown, it should be fairly straightforward to use these techniques to build practical circuits. And I think it should give you everything you need to be able to craft a good solution to your problems. I think that's the last slide that they have here on the CD. But in the pages, which should be in your printout and on the CD-ROM that came with it, I have 6 or 7 pages of references, and they're keyed to the references that are on the slides. And one of the best things I think you could do if you're thinking about doing clock and data recovery in the future is to go back and spend a couple days, and there's at most 5 or 6 papers per year, ISSCC, and some of the early years maybe there's only 3 or 4, and read through them. And you'll see quite a good survey of techniques. Basically every paper will do everything completely different, and they have pros and cons, and hopefully you've been sensitized to some of the things which make it easier and some of the things which make it harder, and be a really good way to get up to speed on what the state of the art is. So that's all I have, and I'd be willing to take some questions, and if anyone has to go, I'll hang around here for a while and also answer questions afterwards.